Part 2 of 6 from set number 1009, C.G. Jung's 7 Sermons. This is a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Fullness, Sun, and Abraxas.
On the last occasion, a week ago, we indicated that particularly the 20th century, which has now happily passed into, if not into oblivion, then at least into the mists of time. I remember, you know, some time ago when there were all kinds of troubles going on in England, the much aggrieved queen said that this had been an annus horribilis, which means a horrible year. Well, I think that the 20th century was the horrible century as well. But in any event, perhaps just because of that, the 20th century was the century of depth psychology. That is where the long and sort of convoluted tradition and transmission that came from Franz Anton Mesmer back at the end of the 18th century came to manifest first in the form of psychoanalysis through Sigmund Freud, and then the analytical psychology, as it came to be called, through Carl Gustav Jung. And really the only thing that is very important for our purposes to remember about this is that while this is a circumstance probably not very frequently mentioned by people in the psychoanalytic profession, it all started out with altered states of consciousness. We went into some detail about that last time, and I don't need to do that now. But let's just remember that the avenue of access to the deep mind, to what came to be called the unconscious in its various divisions, the access to that was gained by the altering of consciousness, which originally was practiced by Mesmer and came to be called as Mesmerism, and which subsequently became known under the name of hypnotism, that Freud himself, originally along with his partner Breuer, had contained in one, and that this is sort of the psychological origin of the human psyche. So that before the little baby is born from the mother's womb, probably, you know, throughout the existence of the fetus, and so forth back there, that ouroboric consciousness exists. It's still there. And it's difficult, no doubt, for a psychologist at that time to speak about that, that probably even before that body was conceived, it's there. That's the origin. And then just as the baby emerges from the mother's womb, the little nascent ego, at this time still potentially so, emerges from that unconscious. So that's a little pleroma in our minds. And from that, by that kind of emanation, we, as we know ourselves, the ego, comes forth. And then, of course, begins its journey. And in the course of the journey, you will see very soon what happens, because the very next sermon, in the second sermon, we see that this original oneness now divides into two. Taoism, Tao, and the yin and the yang. From the one come the two, from the two come from the 10,000 myriad things. And then we are, the process of differentiation takes place. And now what at one time was all one, potential, the uncarved block, you find that also in Chinese thought, but you find it in many places, that, you know, when you have an uncarved piece of wood, let's say, and you have a sculptor, he can see potentially in that uncarved block all kinds of things. There can be a dog, there can be a horse, there can be a man, there can be a woman, there can be a child. It's all in there potentially. But once he begins to carve away and shape, the potentiality becomes actual, then all the other potentialities went away, because this is the only thing now. So that is how things come forth from that original realm of potentials. Another level of application of this, which is yet of a little different nature, although again it's psychological in nature, has to do with creativity. Now, before any kind of creative act, whatever it is, what is? Before you start writing a poem, before you start painting a canvas, before you start a sculpture, whatever the case may be, before you start even planning a good meal, a great deal of creativity goes into that, believe you me, very important creativity. The culinary art is an art. So, what is there before that? Well, the potentialities balance each other out. They are in a state of equilibrium, and therefore nothing happens. And it's a kind of a nice feeling when you, especially if it's justified, you say, well, if I wanted to, I could sit down this evening and start another book, In fact, they're wanting me to do it, which is true, and so forth. I could, but you know what? I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it primarily because I'm here with you, but the other reasons are I'm not doing it. But I have that feeling of omnipotence almost. I could. All I need to do is get to, I don't write on the computer, to hell with that. I write on my trusty old typewriter. This is IBM Selectric, it's just it's good enough for me, like the old time religion, But the thing is, you have that, the potential is there. And there's the potential of all kinds of other things. I could write about this, I could write about that, I could have something else. But while these potentials sort of keep each other in balance, in an equilibrated state, nothing happens. I'm not exercising my creativity. But then something happens, whatever it is. Maybe your publisher calls you up and says, "Hey, I sure like to give you a nice advance, but you got to give me a few chapters." You understand? Motivation. Aha! So the balance now is upset. And now you go forth and do something for whatever reason. But when you do, then you limit the other possibilities, right? You do this rather than that or that or that or that. And, this is kind of what distinguishes the artist from the kind of artsy folk, who congregate in places like Taos, New Mexico, and, other places. However, you meet people like that. They usually like to rub shoulders and whatever else there is to rub with other artists and things like that. But, they are the artists, they are very creative, and I've known them 10 years, I've known them 20 years, I've known them 30 years. You know what? They haven't produced one bloody thing. They haven't done anything. But they're happy being unproductive artists. They are. Why? Because they enjoy the potential. I could do this, I could do that, and then I could do that. But of course I'm not doing a doggone thing. But there is a certain kind of feeling of power in what you could do, even though you don't do anything. Because when you start doing something, then the problems arise. It doesn't look good. People don't want to buy it. all sorts of things like that. But, so you have that pleromic condition, that fullness, where the potentialities cancel each other out, but then when that becomes unbalanced, when the sort of a crisis arises in the pleroma, then something begins to happen. The event is now occurring, the creative act occurs. So the creativity in action depends on the disturbance of that equilibrium. Now, I think that it really would be somewhat redundant in this situation to read the entirety of that first sermon, because it just reiterates over and over again this nature of the pleroma. Now we come to the second sermon and things begin to change. Incidentally, the sermons get shorter as the work progresses. During the night, the dead stood along the walls and shouted, "We want to know about God. Where is God? Is God dead?" Now, of course, here a little bit of Nietzsche comes in, who was a rather well-known character at that time. Of course, the thing about Nietzsche, that somebody, a student, wrote on the blackboard in a class, "God is dead," signed Nietzsche. And the next time they came back to class, somebody wrote, Nietzsche is dead, signed God. You know that one. In any event, you know, the God is dead was a big buzzword around that time in the wake of Nietzsche, and then it became that again sort of in the early 1960s when there was a whole The Death of God, theologians, Althusser and Hamilton from Stanford, and so it comes up now and then. Of course, what they really mean by it is that the traditional God image, the image of the monotheistic God, is not very operative, not very appealing anymore. But anyway, they asked, is God dead? Now it comes the answer. The teacher says, God is not dead. He is as much alive as ever. God is in the created world inasmuch as he is something definite, and therefore he is differentiated from the pleroma. God is a quality of the pleroma, and everything that I have stated in reference to the created world is equally true of him. So there is something that has come out of the Supreme. He is less differentiated than the created world itself, because the ground of his being is effective fullness. And only to the extent that he is definite and differentiated is he identical with the created world, and thus is he the manifestation of the effective fullness of the pleroma. And then there is a somewhat terrifying passage. Even as it said earlier that this God whom he's talking about, sometimes he calls the God Helios, the Greek word for the sun, light, the principle of light, solar logos, things like that. But then he says, the effective emptiness is the being of the devil. And the term that he uses is the German word Teufel, which means devil. Not demon, not evil, but the devil. God and devil are the first manifestation of the nothingness, which we call the pleroma. It does not matter whether the pleroma is or is not, for it cancels itself out in all things. Here in creation, however, in the created world, it is different. Inasmuch as God and devil are created beings, they do not cancel each other out, rather they stand against each other as active opposites. We need no proof of their being. It is sufficient that we must always speak about them. Even if they did not exist, the created being would forever, because of its own differentiated nature, bring them forth out of the pleroma. God and devil, I'm skipping a little again, are distinguished by fullness and emptiness, generation and destruction. Activity is common to both. Activity unites them. It is for this reason that activity stands above both, being God above God, for it unites fullness and emptiness in its own working. The second sermon is much shorter, and it ends with an interesting keynote, which I will come to in a minute. But what we have here is what? Is the beginning of duality. Duality. Now, of course, dualism is something that is a kind of a bugaboo. It's a bad term. And of course it has been applied derisively to us Gnostics for a long, long time. Oh, they are dualists. They are dualists. Now, Jung, even as is increasingly known of the ancient Gnostics, Jung had an unusual and rather specific view of this dualism. And you can see it by the progression of the sermons. In the ultimate, in the original reality, all is one. No duality. No duality. But when manifestation takes place, when differentiation takes place, dualities arise. And that's why he starts with the truth, which is sort of it's probably a kind of a medieval Christianized Gnostic image. A good God and the devil. You know? And fullness and an emptiness. The principle that builds and the principle that destroys. And goes on and on like that. This is the beginning of the duality. So indicating that in manifestation, all kinds of dualities always exist. And there are other manifest dualities further down when we come to the other sermons. And what is the conclusion to be derived from this as well? It is that we need to recognize that at the existential level of our manifest embodied existence, we really can't get away from the dualities. They're always here. When we try to get away from them, what we usually do is we exalt one of them to a supreme status and we'll say, this is the only real, and the other one is unreal. Jung, of course, was very concerned about, which he mentioned then very extensively in his book Answer to Job and elsewhere, about something that has arisen in Christianity, wherein the Christian God, you know, is regarded as all good, and the reality of evil is really denied. Evil is an absence of good. And when you have that as a reality image of existence in the world, then you become rather unbalanced. Jung said that we are forever chasing, so to say, trying to catch the good, and at the same time we've been caught by evil. Why? Because we turned our back on evil. As we run after the good, you know, trying to get hold of it there, evil is behind us and catches us. And so that the dualities have to be recognized. Yes, here is this, here is that. Why? Well, ultimately you will see, and you will now soon begin to see the beginning of that there is not only this ongoing and really tedious duality in the world, because dualities can be very, very tedious, because they're always there, and when you choose one, the other one catches up with you. That's why life is so miserable so often. It's the dualities beating you up all the time. They do. But there is something else. There is the principium individuationis, which he mentioned, principle of individuation, which means there is a mechanism, a possibility within the world of dualities for the interaction, the reconciliation, ultimately even the union of the dualities. So that we live within an existence of dualities so that we can reconcile them. We can make them come closer together. And of course, this is connected with recognition that Jung came to fairly early in his life. I think I mentioned it last time, that we are not one. We act as if we were a unitary being, but we have sort of part selves within us, autonomous complexes. These are dualities in our own nature. And they fight with us and with each other. And they cause all kinds of trouble and all kinds of disturbance. And that really our task is to reconcile and to unite all of these and to become one. That is the psychological meaning of this. But I firmly believe, while Jung intimated that, and maybe he says more about it indeed, the other, you know, in the writings that are coming, that there is also kind of a larger, a kind of metaphysical reality of this. Because once the battle of the duality ceases in us, and we have managed a reconciliation, then we are able to view and converse with and ultimately unite with the higher, with the ultimate. Until we do that, that is not possible. We are caught in a world of dualities, but we do have the ability and the possibility to undo that. And so he comes up now at the end of the second sermon and throughout the third sermon with an awesome image that is sort of Nietzschean in scope. It's wild. It's really wild. And that is his image of Abraxas. Now, I need to say something about that. Jung assumed, on the basis of some statements that may or may not be correct, that Basilides wrote about Abraxas. And he may have. But we don't find really in that little bit of writing that we have from Basilides that's quoted, we don't find any reference to Abraxas. But we find references to Abraxas in other Gnostic scriptures, Pistis Sophia, and in Natsamadhi scriptures. And what emerges from that is a picture that is not really the same as Jung's image of Abraxas here, but compatible with it. In the Gnostic mythology, Abraxas is the second son of Sophia. Sophia, the divine wisdom in her, you know, this is a whole great myth, and I certainly can't recount it now, in her great distress when she is alienated from the source, emanates or sort of gives birth to two beings. The one we hear much more about is the Demiurge. This is a not very bright and more than a little bit nasty kind of a fellow who creates a world and maybe other worlds too, and who simply forgets about his mother and the higher worlds and says, I am the only God and there are no other gods before me. You probably find in the Old Testament that statement attributed to somebody, but I'm not going to say who at the present moment. Anyway, you know, this one is an unfortunate kind of a being that we are still dealing with. But the second son is Abraxas, whose mystical name is also Iao, and which is connected then with salvation. And this one turns to his mother, recognizes his mother, and converts and doesn't want to have anything to do with his nasty brother anymore. And then Sophia brings him back and places him as the ruler of the seventh heaven, which means, of course, the highest of the planetary regions, as the ancients envisioned it. And from that seventh heaven, he is enthroned, and he calls the sparks of light to come up from there, and his representation is usually that of a hybrid being. You have seen his representations on the ancient and the old amulets and talismans, which go back to this. He has the head of a rooster, he has the torso and the arms of a man, he has legs that look like snakes. And in his one arm he holds a shield and the other one a whip, and sometimes he drives four horses. And through his rooster-like head, he crows and he shouts out in the high heavens, you know, light, light, boundless light, awaken, awaken to the light. So it's a very magical figure. And for some reason, which we don't really know in detail, it seems that an awful lot of people in Alexandrian Egypt really liked Abraxas. And they made medals and all kinds of representations galore and wore them, along with certain mystic words, and wore them as a reminder, really, of our potential for liberation. Very important sort of magical, well, just like people wear sacred medals today, a medal of Saint Benedict, and a miraculous medal, and so forth. Now, Jung's Abraxas is a little bit different from that, and I'll read the entire thing to you, even if I can't comment on it too much today anymore, then I'll do the commenting later. But let me just say, in case I don't have the time to comment, that rather obviously to me, what we have here now, you know, we had the one, the ultimate, the two, the good and the evil, the light and the dark fighting with each other. Now we have, on the third level, we have the fourth being who is really the force, the incredible transcendental force that can be used for unification. So to Jung, the Abraxas is the energy which will make for individuation, which will make for enlightenment. Incredible, but it exists on all levels, and it's incredibly fierce energy which at times can be rather terrifying. All I can say, if you accept it or not, that not quite in Jung's form, but there are several of us who have had experiences with that energy. And it's fierce. It's beautiful and it's terrifying. It shimmers in all the colors of the rainbow. It moves. It's fantastic. I think the Hindus came fairly close to it with their Kundalini, which is said to exist in the cosmos as well as in the individual. So already at the latter part of the second sermon, where he spoke of the duality of God and devil, now he begins with Abraxas. There is a God about whom you know nothing, because men have forgotten him. We call him by his name Abraxas. He is less definite than God or devil. Still less definite because more energy than anything else. In order to distinguish God from him, we call God Helios, or the sun. Abraxas is activity. Nothing can resist him but the unreal, and thus his active being freely unfolds. The unreal is not, and therefore cannot truly resist. Abraxas stands above the sun and above the devil, above the duality, see? He is the unlikely likely one who is powerful in the realm of unreality. If the Pleroma were capable of having a being, Abraxas would be its manifestation. These are all clues. I'm not going to interrupt myself anymore. Because when I do that, then I get annoyed with myself. You know what I mean? Although he is activity itself, he is not a particular result, but result in general. He is active non-reality because he has no definite result. He is still a created being inasmuch as he is differentiated from the Pleroma. The sun has a definite effect, and so does the devil. Therefore, they appear to us more effective than the undefinable Abraxas, for his power, endurance, change. At this point, the dead caused a great riot, because they were Christians. Well, you know, that's even true nowadays today. You know, if you now and then you hear Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, and, you know, they cause a great riot, because they think they are Christians. But then, in the third sermon, the dead approached like mist out of the swamps, and they shouted, "Speak to us further about this highest God." And now he speaks. Abraxas is the God whom it is difficult to know. His power is the very greatest because man does not perceive it at all. Man sees the summum bonum, which is the supreme good of the sun, and also the infinum malum, the endless evil of the devil. But Abraxas he does not see, for his undefinable life itself, which is the mother of good and evil alike. Life appears smaller and weaker than the supreme good. Wherefore it is hard to think that Abraxas should supersede in his power the sun, Helios, which is the radiant fountain of all life force. Abraxas is the sun, and also the eternally gaping abyss of emptiness, of the diminisher and dissembler, the devil. The power of Abraxas is twofold. You cannot see it, because in your eyes the opposition of this power seems to cancel it out. That which is spoken by God the Son is life. That which is spoken by the devil is death. Abraxas, however, speaks the venerable and also accursed word, which is life and death at once. Abraxas generates truth and falsehood, good and evil, light and darkness, and unites them with the same word and in the same deed. Therefore, Abraxas is truly the terrible one. He is magnificent even as the lion at the very moment when he strikes his prey down. His beauty is like the beauty of a spring morn. Indeed, he is himself the greater Pan and also the lesser. He is Priapos. These are, you know, ancient gods having to do with generation, sexual power, and so forth. He is the monster of the underworld, the octopus with 1,000 tentacles. He is the twistings of winged serpents and of madness. Schlangengewirbel Raserei. He is the hermaphrodite of the lowest beginning. He is the lord of toads and frogs. Now, this I like. Who live in water and come out onto the land, and who sing together at high noon and at midnight. He is fullness uniting itself with emptiness. He is the sacred wedding. He is love and the murder of love. He is the holy one and his betrayer. He is the brightest light of day and the deepest night of madness. To see him means blindness, to know him is sickness, to worship him is death, to fear him is wisdom. Not to resist him means liberation. God lives behind the sun, the devil lives behind the night. What God brings into birth from the light, that the devil pulls into the night. The ongoing cycle of the opposites. Abraxas, however, is the cosmos, is Genesis and its dissolution. To every gift of God the Son, the devil adds his curse. You know, there are individual statements here that could stand on their own. All things which you beg from God the Son generate an act of the devil. All things which you accomplish through God the Son add to the effective might of the devil. But such is the terrible Abraxas. He is the mightiest manifest being, and in him creation becomes frightened of itself. He is the revealed protest of creation against the Pleroma and its nothingness. He is the terror of the Son, S-O-M, which he feels against his mother. He is the love of the mother for her son. He is the delight of earth and the cruelty of heaven. Man becomes paralyzed before his face. Before him there exists neither question nor answer. He is the life of creation. He is the activity of differentiation. He is the love of man. He is the speech of man. He is both the radiance and the dark shadow of man. He is deceitful reality. Here the dead howled and raved greatly, for they were still incomplete ones. That's how the dead receive it. I read this one completely on purpose. Let me reiterate that, let's say, the poetic grandeur and awesome qualities of this imagery certainly need not to be taken literally, but I think what they are designed to accomplish is a sense of awe, a sense of the mysterium tremendum, as it is called in Latin, the mystery that makes you tremble. And when one acquires that toward this incredible force, this incredible power, then that is the first step toward that power turning in a benign fashion to our advantage. Because, let's be clear about that, we have come to our present condition as the result of eons of great and terrible and dark developments. We have become alienated from our source and from the light, not in the twinkling of an eye, but as the result of great and heavy processes. What will undo this? What will undo them? Not even God himself crucified on a piece of wood will undo it. There can be awakenings, there can be great help and great grace come to us through the messengers of light. But what they do, among others, is to awaken and to turn to the advantage of the Spirit these incredible forces, these incredible energies, which when, if we are confronted with them, are truly terrifying. And they can unhinge you if you are in the midst of them and you really perceive them. But on the other hand, when they begin to work to your advantage, they will turn all the darkness in a way that it will open to you, and they will become openers of the way. And so Jung did not really create an image that is incompatible with the Gnostic image, although it's a little different. And I think we can keep in our minds from the third sermon and the end of the second that there are great forces here which, when they turn to our advantage, will help to liberate us, will help to lift us, because it takes incredible power, it takes incredible force to undo the heaviness, the evil, the darkness, the incomprehension, the stupidity, the mire and the muck in which we are stuck. But we will not remain stuck forever, because up on the in the seventh heaven, there stands mythically this curious being with the head of the rooster, and he says, yes, yes, you will come, light, boundless light, liberation, freedom, and it raises the powers that rise up from below and that lift us up on above. And the more precise psychological and related meanings of this I will discuss when we start on the fourth and the fifth sermon next time. Until which time, I thank you very much and I hope to see you soon.
Copyright MMD by BC Recordings. Catalog number 100902. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG.